Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Brains Bible Institute. I'm Pastor Tim Warner, your teacher. We are in module number 9 on the Christian home. This is lesson number 8, which is part 3 regarding the Christian woman. Now, this week, I would like to get into the issue of head coverings that's dealt with in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. Excuse me. But before I go there, I just want to make an observation or make a comment about an observation that I noticed recently while I have been studying in preparation for these classes. As many of you know, I have been working on my own translation of the New Testament, and so I've been doing Paul's epistles. I'm almost finished with Paul's epistles, but I've been working on that for quite a long time, and so, you know, over time I have really gotten a feel for the language, the way Paul handles the Greek grammar and the way he handles language in his epistles. And as you know, most of his epistles are addressed to specific congregations, specific assemblies from different areas and so forth. And one thing that I noticed fairly recently is a pattern that the Apostle Paul seems to follow in his letters. Most of his letters contain commands, right? They usually give theological information up front, and then that's followed by a series of commands on how, as a Christian, we should behave ourselves. And most of those commands are given generally to the whole congregation. But there are times when the Apostle Paul has to be specific with regard to commands for men and commands for women. And when he does that, I noticed something that seems to be a consistent pattern with Paul and also with Peter when they do that. And that is that when they address the men, they use verbs in the imperative mood. Now, not always, but frequently, they use verbs in the imperative mood. Now, an imperative mood verb means it's a command. It is a direct command from the speaker to the audience. And so it's common for the apostle to use the imperative mood when he's speaking to the assembly generally, or when he's speaking to the men. But whenever he is addressing his teaching towards the wives, he seems to abandon that, and instead of using the imperative mood and the second person, which is what he does for men or for commands in general, he switches to the third person. Now, if you don't know anything about English grammar, you won't know anything about what I'm talking about, but just some basics about grammar. When somebody is speaking to someone else and it's being addressed to that person, it's called second. When the person is speaking about themselves, they speak in the first person. But if they're speaking to someone about a third party, about another person, in other words, they're not speaking directly to that third party, but they're speaking about the third party, they use what is called the third person. All right, so that's true in English grammar, and it's also true in Greek grammar as well. Well, what we find is when the Apostle Paul begins to give instructions for women, he suddenly switches to the third person. Now, in English, it's rather difficult for us to translate a command that's given to the third person, because we don't usually speak that way in English. You know, if I'm talking to someone and I tell them, if I say, husbands, do this, I'm talking directly to those husbands. But if I give a command to the husband concerning his wife, which is what the Apostle Paul does, he speaks in the third person, but he gives a command. In English, it's hard to do that. It's hard to translate it that way into English, because that's not normally the way that we speak. But you could you could translate it. I mean, most often in our English Bibles, it will say, "Let them blah blah blah," whatever the command happens to be. All right, let them. Now, the word "let" is being addressed to the person he's speaking to. And then "them" is referring to a third person. And actually, that's not really a great translation, the word "let" there, because "let" in English implies simply allowing something as opposed to doing something, right? So to say "let them be covered," as we'll look at in this particular passage, a better rendering in English would be "have her be covered," because it's commanding the man to do something with regard to his wife's actions and his wife's behavior, all right? And I noticed this pattern in Paul. In fact, in all of the passages that we're going to deal with, which are pretty much, all the passages that directly deal with women and women's issues in the New Testament, that the Apostle Paul and the Apostle Peter always seem to follow this pattern of addressing the wives through their husbands, which is what this grammar implies. Now, this shouldn't come as a surprise to us, though, if you think about it, because all the way back at the beginning, we learned that God is the one who instructed Adam concerning both he and his wife. It says that in Genesis 2:16, it says, "And the Lord God commanded the man, saying, you know, of all the trees you may freely eat, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you may not eat, lest you die." All right. So he commanded the man. He expected the man then to convey the information to his wife, and he expected the man to see to it that his wife obeyed these commands from God as well. And so what I notice is that what the Apostle Paul seems to be doing is he is deferring to the husband. Whenever he's giving these commands in his epistles, his letters to the various congregations, he is actually addressing the man concerning his wife's behavior. So the way he does that, again, is he uses the imperative mood, which is a command, but he puts it in the third person, speaking about the third party, the wife, as opposed to the second person, which would be speaking about the man's own actions and behaviors. Now, the other way that the Apostle Paul or Peter deal with wives is they don't actually make a command. They sort of imply a command. And that's done by using the subjunctive mood or by using the infinitive form of the verb. The subjunctive form is saying what should be. It's stating, wives should do this. Wives should, you know, honor their husbands, or wives should respect their husbands. Again, if you say somebody should do something, you're not commanding them to do it. You're simply saying that that's the right thing for them to do. All right, so that's different than addressing them directly and personally. Or the other way is to use the infinitive, and that would be wives are to be subject to their husbands. All right, using the to be form of the verb, which is the infinitive form. All right. So again, this is those both the subjunctive mood and the infinitive mood are simply stating what ought to be or what godly women are, as opposed to saying, "Hey, women, do this." Okay, that's different. That's more direct. Now, when the apostles wrote these letters to the congregations, they understood that there was a mixed audience. They understood that there are husbands and wives and children all present in the assembly, and they are directing their commands to the congregation whenever it's general commands, but whenever it's with regard to the women, the wives, the commands do not go directly to the wife. The commands go to the husband with regard to his wife. And that's really, it's really a very enlightening concept when you see this pattern being repeated time and time again. In fact, I went through all those passages that I told you we were going to examine in this series, and I looked at the structure of the grammar throughout all of those passages, and this pattern is followed in all of them. Now, there is one exception that I need to clarify, and that is in Colossians 3:18. In our New King James Version, it says, "Women, submit to your husbands," or "be submissive to your husbands." And it in the English, it appears to be speaking in the second person, that is directly to the women. I looked at the Greek text, and the Greek text that underlies the New King James Version does indeed use the second person there. But I also went back and looked at the other manuscript evidence, and what I found was that the older manuscripts, the really old manuscripts, do not have that verb in the second person. Basically, it's an infinitive, and it basically says wives are to be subject to their own husbands. Again, not directly addressing the wife, but simply stating a fact of what ought to be. All right? So in any case, it seems to be a pattern that is followed continuously throughout the epistles, that the apostle does not go around the husband's authority and instruct his wife directly. Rather, he instructs the husband with the idea in mind that he is to instruct his wife with regard to these things. Or, you know, she's to overhear it as well, because these letters were read in the whole congregation. But by speaking directly to the husband, the implication is he's not going around the husband when he is speaking about the wife. Okay? So that keep that in mind as we look through these passages of Scripture, because it says a lot about the apostles' mentality and how they viewed this very delicate subject that we're talking about here, which is the role of women with regard to their husbands and being submissive and so forth. The whole point of authority. Now, let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 11. I want to deal with this passage, which gets into that concept of authority. And it talks about head coverings, but really head coverings is only really a side issue. The real issue is authority and whether or not the wife is being submissive to her husband in the manner in which God requires of the woman. All right, so let's go there. 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 2. Now, let me point out that verse 1 is a, really, the chapter division should be after verse 1. That is, verse 2 should be verse 1, and verse 1 should be attached to the end of chapter 10, because it's a closing statement regarding the topic that the Apostle Paul was talking about, that is his own behavior and the Corinthians imitating his own behavior. And then in chapter 11, verse 2, he starts a new subject. All right. Let's look at verse 2. It says, "Now I am praising you, brothers, because you have remembered me in everything, and you are observing the traditions accordingly as I gave to you." Now, I'm reading from my translation. That's the last generation version. If you don't have a copy of it, you can go to the website, the church website, later and download the notes for this class, and then the translation will be contained in those notes, okay? But you'll just have to listen for now. All right, let me read that again. "Now I am praising you, brothers." Note that who is he addressing? The brothers, right? Now, that's a term that could refer to the whole assembly, but it refers to specifically to the men. He says, "Because you have remembered me in everything, and you are observing the traditions accordingly as I gave to you." So he starts out by sort of giving them a little pat on the back, saying, "You're doing a good job with regard to the commandments and the traditions that I gave to you." Now he's talking about the use of head coverings. That is, the man is not to cover his head, and the woman is to cover her head in the assembly. All right, so he's acknowledging that they are following the traditions that he gave them. But what he says in the next verse is that he wants to give them, he wants to really give them the theological reasons why he gave those traditions to them in the first place, which they were faithfully keeping. All right, so he says, "Yet I desire you to have observed that the head of every man is Christ." Now, it's interesting that he uses the perfect tense verb there. He doesn't just say, "I desire you to know." That would be a present tense form of the verb ginosko. But he doesn't use that verb here. He uses the verb that literally means to see with the eyes. Now, it's used figuratively all through the scriptures with regard to understanding. But it's different than just having knowledge. It is having understanding because you see. That is, you have observed something. It's in the perfect tense because the perfect tense describes something that has happened in the past, but the result of that continues to the present. So when it's used with regard to knowledge, the idea is that you have observed something, and because you have observed it, you know it. You have a certain amount of knowledge based on what you have observed, okay? And that's the reason why that particular verb is used in this way. So he says, "I desire you to have observed," that is to have seen something and then have that knowledge from that. Now, they would have to see it from somewhere, and it's actually, as we will see as we go through this passage, it's from the creation account is what Paul wants them to observe these points from, all right? So he says, "I desire you to have observed that the head of every man is Christ, the head of woman is the man, and the head of Christ is God." Now, this word head is an interesting word. It's literally, it refers to your head, right? The part that's sitting up there on top of your shoulders. But in the Bible, you know, metaphors are used frequently. And so head as a metaphor means your superior, someone who you are subject to, someone who is above you. All right, if you're referring to your head. And that's because the reason it's used metaphorically that way is because our head is where our brain is, and our head is where our most of our senses for communicating are located. And so it's our head that dictates what the rest of our body does, right? So taking that in a metaphorical sense, the person who calls the shots, who's above other people, superior in rank to other people, would be their head, all right, using it metaphorically. And that's a pretty easy concept for us to understand. All right, so he lays out this principle that is going to form the basis of all the rest of the passage. And that is that there is a ranking system that God has put into place. At the top of this rank is God, the Father. And then he is the head of Christ, is what the passage says. Now, in fact, there are passages that talk about the Father being Jesus God. For example, when Jesus rose from the dead and he appeared to Mary, he said to go tell his disciples that I am going to ascend to my God and to your God. Wow. My God and to your God. So what he's saying is that the Father's relationship to you as being your supreme authority, that he is also my supreme authority. He is Jesus God. Jesus God is the Father, right? So he lays out, in verse 3, Paul lays out this order. God is the ultimate head. He is the supreme authority. Under him is Christ, who has the Father as his covering, his authority. Under Christ is the Christian man, that his direct superior is Christ. And under the man is his wife, that her direct superior is her husband. Now, the point of having these superiors, you know, Jesus said that no man comes to the Father except through me. And that's because of this, when Christ came in the flesh and the Father sent him on this mission. And from that point on, when he established his congregation and he established the new covenant, there was no approaching God except through Christ. You don't go around Christ to get to the Father. All right? That's going around your head, your authority. You're not allowed to do that. And so this concept is laid out from the Father to the Son to the husband and then to the wife. And the implication is not only that the wife has an authority over her who is the man, but the implication is the same that she has no right to approach Christ apart from her husband if she's married. That's really what this implies. All right, she is seen by God as being one flesh with her husband as his helper. And for her to go around her husband in order to interact with Christ directly outside of her husband's authority, that is something that is not allowed or not recognized by God. And we'll see as we progress that this is the case. All right. Now, he goes on, now he says in verse 4, and he's going to talk about those traditions that he had given them, which was for the man to uncover his head when he was in the assembly where they are interacting directly with God by means of the Spirit, all right? The breath, the holy breath of God, which brings heaven and earth together. It brings, you know, God throne and his Son at his right hand. It brings them right down present in the congregation. Or you could look at it the other way. It brings the whole congregation into the presence or the throne room of God. But that's the idea of being in the Spirit, that the Spirit or the breath of God brings these heaven and earth together when we meet as an assembly in Jesus' name. And so in that assembly is where praying and prophesying and things take place, which are, both of those things are a manner of interacting with God by means of his holy breath, interacting directly with God by means of his holy breath. And it's that situation that he's addressing here, all right? He's not talking about women's clothing when they're at home doing their housework or when they go shopping or anything like that. He's not dealing with that. It's not part of this discussion, okay? All right, so he says in verse 4, he says, every man praying or prophesying, having anything upon the head, and that means anything that would cover his head, is dishonoring his head. Now, it's using the word head here in both ways that it's used in the New Testament, all right? It's talking about his physical head, right? If he's covering his physical head, then he's dishonoring his head, that is Christ, who is his authority, all right? So, you don't want to dishonor your head. That is the one who has direct authority over you, all right? So he says, if a man covers his head in this situation where they're interacting with God through his Spirit, that he is disgracing his head, which means if the man covers his head, he is disgracing Christ, his superior. But then it says, verse 5, but every woman praying or prophesying with uncovered head is dishonoring her head. Now again, it's using the word head in both ways. Covering or uncovered head, meaning uncovered head here. If she approaches God with this uncovered head, then she's dishonoring the one who God has made her head. That is her husband. All right, she's dishonoring him. And in the assembly, she's dishonoring him publicly. She's publicly disgracing her husband. That's what the passage says. All right. Now, before we move on, I want to turn to a passage of Scripture, and I want to show you how this idea of a woman covering her head in the presence of God as a symbol that she is under the authority of her husband, that she recognizes her husband's authority over her, and that she is approaching God from that perspective or from that position. All right, let's go to Numbers, the book of Numbers, chapter 5. And let's start reading in verse 11. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, if a man's wife goes astray and behaves unfaithfully towards him, and the man and a man lies with her carnally, and it is hidden from the eyes of her husband," that is, it's a secret affair, right? And it is concealed that she has defiled herself, and there was no witness against her, nor was she caught. "If the spirit of jealousy comes upon him," that is her husband, "and he becomes jealous of his wife who has defiled herself, or if the spirit of jealousy comes upon him, and he becomes jealous of his wife, although she has not defiled herself." Now, it's talking about a husband suspecting that his wife has been unfaithful to him. And, you know, there are certain behavior patterns that, you know, that if a man is intuitive, he can pick up on if his wife is running around on him, all right? There's certain things, certain manners, certain lack of respect, certain things that seem to creep in, and a man may begin to suspect. All right, but he may not know. And there could be other reasons why this behavior is going on. But the point is, what God is doing here in this passage through the law of Moses is he was giving Israel, under the law, a manner in which God himself would judge whether someone was guilty or not guilty. All right, let's continue reading. It says, "Then the man shall bring his wife to the priest, and he shall bring the offering required for her, one-tenth of an ephah of barley meal, and he shall pour no oil on it, but and put no frankincense upon it, because it is a grain offering of jealousy, an offering for remembering, for bringing iniquity to remembrance," that is, to bring something to light, whether there has been this transgression or not from his wife. Now notice verse 16, this is important. "The priest shall bring her near and set her before the Lord." Now, what it's saying, if the priest brings her and sets her before the Lord, the priest is bringing her before God for God to judge her without her husband's authority over her. That is, God is going to judge her independently of her husband. And we'll see that that's the case in just a minute. Verse 17, "The priest shall take holy water in an earthen vessel and take some of the dust that is on the floor of the tabernacle and put it into the water. Then the priest shall stand the woman before the Lord." Now notice this. He stands her before the Lord and he uncovers the woman's head. That is, he removes her veil. Because if the woman was at the tabernacle, if the woman was approaching God to worship in any way, she had to be veiled. And so the priest now is going to stand her before the Lord and he's going to uncover her head. Now, what does that symbolize when he removes the veil from her head and she's standing before the Lord? What it symbolizes is she is now without the covering of her husband's authority. She is standing before the Lord on her own. Okay? And then it says, "And he shall put the offering for remembrance in her hands, which is the grain offering of jealousy, and the priest shall have in his hand the bitter water that brings a curse. And the priest shall put her under oath and say to the woman, if no man has lain with you, and if you have not gone astray to uncleanness," now notice this next phrase, "while under your husband's authority, be free from the bitter water that brings a curse. But if you have gone astray while under your husband's authority, and if you have defiled yourself, and some man other than your husband has lain with you, then the priest shall put the woman under oath of the curse, and he shall say to the woman, the Lord make you a curse and an oath among your people when the Lord makes your thigh rot and your belly swell. And may this water that brings the curse go into your stomach and make your belly swell and your thigh rot. Then the woman shall say, amen, so be it." That is, she is swearing this oath before the Lord without being under her husband's authority. And that was signified by the priest removing her veil from her head. All right? Now let's continue down to verse 27. When he has made her drink the water, then it shall be, if she has defiled herself and behaved unfaithfully towards her husband, that the water that brings a curse will enter her and become bitter, and her belly will swell, and her thigh will rot, and the woman will become a curse among her people. But if the woman has not defiled herself and is clean, then she shall be free and may conceive children. This is the law of jealousy when a wife under her husband's authority goes astray and defiles herself, or if the spirit of jealousy comes upon a man and he becomes jealous of his wife and so forth. Now, what's happening here is God set up this system at the tabernacle so that he would judge whether the woman was lying or not. But he was going to judge her apart from her husband's authority. He was going to judge her outside of that covering of authority. The symbol that she was being judged and that she was going to stand outside her husband's authority in order to be judged directly by God, right? In other words, she was going to interact directly with God and with the Spirit of God. And, you know, God sees everything, right? God knows everything. He sees, you know, the eyes of the Lord go to and fro throughout the earth. He observes everything. So if somebody has been unfaithful to their spouse, God knows. And so when she takes this oath before God with her head uncovered, God is going to judge her with her head uncovered. He's going to judge her directly, right? As opposed to holding her husband accountable for her actions, he's going to hold her personally accountable for her actions. And the symbol for that was her veil was removed from her head. That is, she's going before God bareheaded. All right? That was what the text says. Now, let's take that concept. Go back to 1 Corinthians chapter 11. Let me go back to verse 4. It says, every man praying or prophesying, having anything upon the head, is dishonoring his head. But every woman praying or prophesying with uncovered head, and again, that concept we just saw in Numbers is the same idea, right? Is dishonoring her head, that is dishonoring her husband. For it is one and the same as having been sheared. Now, it's interesting that he uses this word sheared. It's a term that's used for shearing sheep. And basically, it means to cut the hair off about as short as you can get it. You know, that's what they do. If you've ever seen a sheep that's sheared, they cut it down almost right to the skin. They don't shave it so that there's not even stubble left, but they cut it, and it looks pretty bad. It's kind of choppy looking. I'm sure you've seen what a sheep looks like having been sheared. He says it's one and the same as having been sheared. Now look at verse 6. For if a woman is uncovered, that is, not having her head covered by a veil or a hat or some manner symbolic covering, it says, have her shear herself. Now this is, that phrase that I have there, have her shear herself, I think the New King James says, let her be sheared or let her be shaved or something like that. But again, this is one of those cases where an imperative mood verb, which means it's a command, but it's in the third person, which means he's not talking directly to the one who is supposed to do the action. He's talking to her husband. He's talking to the brothers that he mentioned in verse 2. Okay? That's whom he's addressing throughout this entire passage. So I translated it, instead of let her be sheared or shaved, I have it, let her shear herself. And the reason I said shear herself, I'm sorry, I have her shear herself. The reason I have shear herself instead of be sheared is because the verb is in the middle voice. And the middle voice implies that the action is being done both by the person and to the person at the same time. So whenever you see the middle voice with regard to a verb, like that, it's talking about somebody doing it to themselves. Like if you were going to talk about bathing, you know, you would use the middle voice because, you know, go bathe. You would use the middle voice because you're doing it to yourself. Okay. Anyway, That's what we have here, is the middle voice. So he says, it literally says, have her shear herself. He doesn't say the woman, go shear yourself. He says to the man, have her shear herself. Because he has authority over her. That's the point. See, Paul, he says that the husband has authority over the wife, and he's speaking to the man as though he does have authority over the wife, and he's telling the women indirectly by commanding their husbands regarding what they must do. You see that? All right, so he says, for if the woman is uncovered, that she's not wearing a veil or a hat, she's, you know, bareheaded before the Lord, he says, have her shear herself. Now, I want you to notice that it's clear from this passage, what Paul is essentially saying is, if the woman is going to publicly disgrace her husband by not covering her head when coming into the presence of God, then instead of embarrassing or instead of humiliating her head, her husband, by not covering her head, she should shave off all of her hair and humiliate herself alone as opposed to humiliating her husband. Because a woman with a shaved head was not looked at in ancient times as dishonoring her husband. People sometimes shaved their heads when they were in great grief and mourning. All right, that would not be necessarily a reflection on her husband. But going into the presence of God without covering her head was a disgrace or dishonoring her own husband. So she's humiliating the person who God has placed over her, as opposed to shaving her head and just humiliating herself. So he goes on to say, but if it is dishonorable to a woman to shear herself or to be shaved. Now notice he says it's dishonoring to the woman. He doesn't say if it is dishonorable to her head, her husband. He says, if it is dishonorable to the woman to shear herself. That is, look, if she is going into God's presence without covering her head and she is dishonoring her husband, it would be better for her to dishonor herself and not her husband. That's what he's saying. But then he's saying, look, if you would be embarrassed as a woman to shave your head and go around with a shaved head, then cover up already. That's what he's saying. Then put on a head covering already. All right? If you're not willing to disgrace yourself by shaving your own head, then don't disgrace your husband by refusing to wear a head covering when you approach God, because that's what you're doing. This is what the apostle's teaching here. All right? Now, again, he is not talking to her directly, as I just was. He is talking to the husband about her. All right. Now, is it dishonorable for a woman to shave herself? Now, aside from like a mourning or something like that, there were certain times when that was considered appropriate. All right. But if she just went around all the time with a shaved head and wasn't in mourning, all right, was that something that should be considered disgraceful for a woman? And the answer to that is yes. So let me show you that from Isaiah chapter 3. All right, so let's go there. Isaiah 3 and verse 17. Now, this is a prophecy of God denouncing Jerusalem. But throughout the book of Isaiah, God refers to the city of Jerusalem as a woman. All right, he calls her the daughter of Jerusalem. And he refers to her in the feminine gender, the city in the feminine gender, all through the prophecies of Isaiah when he's talking about the city of Jerusalem. And he does that as well here. He says, therefore the Lord will strike with a scab the crown of the head of the daughters of Zion. Again, it's feminine. And the Lord will uncover their secret parts. Now skip down to verse 24. He's still talking about the judgment that God is going to bring upon the city of Jerusalem. He says, and so it shall be, instead of a sweet smell, there will be a stench. Instead of a sash, a rope. Instead of well-set hair, baldness. Instead of a rich robe, a girding of sackcloth, and branding instead of beauty. Now, he's contrasting two kinds of things with regard to a female, right? Again, using the female as a metaphor for the city of Jerusalem. And so he contrasts different kinds of garments, right? One that is like sackcloth, that's not an honorable garment, or as opposed to, you know, a beautiful robe. He contrasts well-set hair, that is beautiful kept hair that women had, long hair, you know, usually long and nicely done, okay? Well-set means, you know, it's fixed up. It's not just going crazy, right? Well-set hair, he contrasts that with baldness, that is a shaved head. And he's doing these things, talking about, the city of Jerusalem being a beautiful woman as opposed to what God's going to do to her because of all her unfaithfulness. And one of the things he's talking about here is baldness or a shaved head as a thing of disgrace and humbling of a woman, in this case, the city of Jerusalem. All right, so you can see that the Bible does use this kind of terminology with regard to disgrace. A woman's head being shaved or shorn would be considered disgrace, generally speaking, okay? All right, so that's what the Apostle Paul is saying here when he looks at, when we go back to verse 6, he says, for if a woman is uncovered, have her shear herself. But if it is dishonorable to a woman to shear herself or be shaved, have her be covered. And here again, that phrase, have her be covered, is a imperative mood verb, which means it's a command, but it's in the third person. All right? Have her be covered. What that means essentially is, according to Paul, it's the man's responsibility to make sure his wife is covered with a head covering when they go into the presence of God. That's what it's saying. That's what the grammar requires. All right? It's your responsibility, sir, to make sure your wife covers up her head when she goes into God's presence. All right? It doesn't leave it open to the woman to decide. It's commanding the man. All right? All right. Go to Isaiah chapter 6. Some people get confused about this word covered, and they have different ideas of what the word covered means, and they think, well, maybe it doesn't really mean to cover it with something else. All right? But I want to show you that that's clearly the case. It is, and I also want you to notice that covered has an object, that it's not just cover, it has an object, that is the head. It's covering the head. When it says in verse 6, for if a woman, verse 5, but every woman praying or prophesying with uncovered head. It doesn't say uncovered hair, it says uncovered head. All right? All right, so. When it says at the end of verse 6, it says, have her be covered. I want to define that word covered for you by showing you how it's used in the Old Testament in the Septuagint. Okay, so go to Isaiah chapter 6 and verse 2. It's talking about the seraphim, right, who had all these wings and things like that. And it says, above it stood the seraphim. Each one had six wings. With two he covered, same word. He covered his face, and with two, he covered his feet. Notice he's covering something that's stated in the text, covering his face or covering his feet with something else besides his head or his feet. Okay? All right, go to Isaiah chapter 11 and verse 9. We have the same term being used again. They shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. All right, so that whole area of the seabed is covered by water. All right, so again, it shows the meaning of the verb. And one more, just, in the mouth of two or three witnesses, right? So Isaiah chapter 26 and verse 21, we have the same word used again. It says, "For behold, the Lord comes out of his place to punish the inhabitants of the earth for their iniquity. The earth shall also disclose her blood and no more cover her slain." So in other words, the way that, you know, the dirt that's poured in on top of a coffin or burial is covering the slain person. That's the concept of this word that that Paul uses here, which is covered. So he's saying, look, the woman must have her head covered. All right. Now, verse 7. "For a man indeed ought not to cover his head." Now, why not? Well, he's going to take us back to creation. Remember I said before in a couple classes earlier that all of these commands that God gives with regard to husbands and wives, their relationship to one another, and being in submission, and in this case, head covering, he doesn't root these things, the reason for these things, in just normal customs of the day. He roots them in the theology that we find in the book of Genesis at the time of creation with regard to how Eve was created out of the man and also with regard to the curse. So he says, "For a man indeed ought not to cover his head. The image and the glory of God belongs to him." Now I want you to underline the words "glory of God." What he says is what does he mean by "the image and the glory of God belongs to him"? You know, just in the same way that the moon reflects the sun, the glory of the moon is not really the glory of the moon. The moon is very glorious when it's full, isn't it? But it's reflecting the glory of the sun. It's not its own glory. And when God created man in his own image, it was to reflect the glory of God. It's not a direct and exact representation of God in all of his glory, but it is in some way a reflection. And reflections are imperfect, especially back in the day when this was written, when they didn't have glass mirrors like we have today, which are seemingly flawless in the reflection. But back in those days, they used polished metal as a mirror. And so when they talked about reflections, it would be an imperfect reflection, right? Just like metal doesn't give a perfect reflection. All right, so he says that man is the image and the glory of God, or the glory of God belongs to the man. All right, he is the one that has been established by God to reflect God's glory. And then he says, "But the woman is the glory of the man." Now, where's he getting that from? Well, he's getting it from Genesis, because God created the man out of the dust of the ground, and he breathed the breath of life into that man. And that man, with God's breath of life in him, became a living soul or a living person. But it was out of that living man that God had already breathed life into that he created the woman. It doesn't say that he took the rib from Eve, I'm sorry, the rib from Adam and formed Eve, and then he breathed life into Eve directly, the breath of God. He didn't do that. The breath of God was already in that rib that God had taken out of Adam, which is why he took it out of Adam. All right? So Adam was the recipient. The man was the recipient directly of the breath of God. The woman was the recipient of the breath of God indirectly, because she was taken out of the man. All right? And so the Apostle Paul points this out. He says, "But the woman is the glory of man." Verse 8, "For man is not from woman." That is, God didn't create a woman and then take her rib and make a man. He says, "But the woman from the man." And the word "from" there in both cases is the Greek preposition ek, which literally means out from within. All right. So the woman was taken out from within the man. And so Paul is establishing this order as a theological basis for the teaching that he's giving. All right, then he says, verse 9, "Neither was man created through woman, but the woman through man." So he uses he basically says the same thing, but he uses a different preposition, which is the Greek word dia, which means the instrument, something through which something else was done. So God didn't create Eve directly. He created her through the man. That is, the man was the instrument through which he created the woman, because he took her out of the man. All right. verse 10. Therefore, the woman ought to have the authority upon her head for this reason. Now, notice the words ought to. He doesn't say, therefore, woman, make sure you have something on your head. No. He simply states what is appropriate for women in general. Right? He doesn't command her. He says, therefore, the woman ought to have the authority upon her head. And by that, he means that thing that was established to be the sign that she was in submission to her husband. So that when she approaches God and she covers her head with a veil or her hat or whatever it is that's covering her hair and her head, that this is a sign to God that she is not coming to God apart from her husband's authority, but she is coming to God within her husband's authority, by his authority that God has given him as her head. All right? In other words, she's not being out of bounds when she's approaching God by having her head covered. The implication is that if she is approaching God in prayer with her head uncovered, that she's out of bounds. She is out of bounds from God's perspective. All right? I'm not the one who wrote this. God is. Okay? All right. So he goes on to say that, verse 10. Therefore, the woman ought to have the authority upon her head for this reason. And here's the reason. Because of the angels. Well, what does that have to do with anything? Because of the angels. Why does that matter? Well, if you take a look at Ephesians chapter 3, verses 8 through 12, and I don't really have time to go there because I'm running a little long. But in that passage, Ephesians 3, 8 through 12, the Apostle Paul says that God is using the local assembly in order to demonstrate something to the angelic realm. That is, the angelic realm is watching us when we gather together to approach God as the collective assembly. He is teaching them something by means of the assembly, by means of the order that's taking place in the assembly. Now, what is he teaching the angels? Well, for one thing, we have to understand what was the sin of the angels. What was the sin of Satan, first of all? Satan was not content with his assigned role. Satan says, I am going to be like the Most High. Satan wanted to be worshipped, right? He was not content with the role that God had given him. You should read Ezekiel chapter 28. It describes Satan in the Garden of Eden, how that he was leading the worship of God until sin was found in him. And it, by the way, Satan's fall took place in the Garden of Eden, it says, in that passage, which means it was after God created the heavens and the earth. It was on day 6 when he created man and he planted the Garden of Eden, that Satan was in the Garden of Eden. He was there in order to lead the worship of God through music, musical instruments, and so forth. Talks about how beautiful he was, how God gave him all this beauty, but then sin was found in him in the Garden of Eden, and that sin was found in him when he decided he was going to take what was in him, which was him not being willing to remain in a subordinate role. And what he did was he tricked Eve with the very same flaw that he had, right? He told her, hey, you can be like God. God wants to keep you down, but you can be like God. You can take a higher position than this lowly position God has given you if you'll just go ahead and eat from that tree. And so the very same sin that was festering in the heart of Satan himself, he tricked Eve into doing it instead of him doing it. He got her to make the first move to rebel against God. And that's when God cursed the serpent. Isn't that right? I mean, if you read the curse after they sinned, the first thing he did was he cursed the serpent. And then he cursed the woman, and then he cursed the man. So that's when Satan fell in the Garden of Eden. But I want you to notice what it was in his heart that was the sin, which was the sin of arrogance, the sin of not being satisfied with his position and wanting to go outside the bounds that God had set with regard to submission. And so he tricked the woman into doing it. And then, of course, the whole human race fell because Adam capitulated to his wife and he did it also. All right. So let's keep reading. So he's, one more passage. Jot this down. You're gonna look at Ephesians 3, 8 through 12 later, which tells how God is teaching the angels. But it wasn't just Satan who had that problem. It was other angels as well. If you read Jude chapter 1, verse 6, especially in the Greek text, it's clearer than it is in the English. But essentially says he's talking about those angels who left their appointed ranks. They left their appointed ranks. They went outside of their assigned roles. And those are the ones that God is reserving in everlasting chains, it says, sort of figuratively, of course, for the day of judgments. It's the ones that went outside of the bounds that God had set. And again, Satan used that very same sin to deceive Eve into doing it for him. And Eve has been doing it ever since, by the way. If you heard last week's lesson, you'll know what I'm talking about. All right, let's look at verse 11. He says, however, in the Lord, man is not independent of woman, nor woman of man. Now, what the Apostle Paul is doing here, he's showing that there is an order. There is an order of roles with regard to authority. And that when we approach God, we had better be doing it according to the roles and the authority that he has given. But after he says this and he describes how that, you know, man was the one who God created, and then the woman was created for the man and not before the man and all this stuff, then he wants to sort of give the woman the idea that, wait a minute, you're not chopped liver here, because he goes on to say, however, in the Lord, that is in the Christian family, man is not independent of woman, nor woman of man. And that is because they were to become one flesh. All right, verse 12, for just as the woman is from the man, that is, she was taken out of man, thus also man comes through woman. And what he's talking about is procreation. It is through giving birth that a new generation of males comes about. You know, you can't have just the man. If it was just Adam, the whole human race would die with Adam. But because the woman was taken out of man, and now the two of them become one flesh, they have the ability to procreate. And so men come from women. They come from our mothers, right? And so that's the point he's making. He's saying that women are absolutely essential and a necessary component to this unit that is one flesh. But this unit that is one flesh has to have a leader, and the leader must be the man. All right, this is clearly what the passage is teaching. All right, then he says, yet everything comes from God. Verse 13, judge this for yourselves. Now, what Paul is going to do here is he is going to call upon what is considered appropriate, just generally speaking, cross-culturally, okay? Not just the custom of one nation or one, you know, one group of people, but what is sort of cross-cultural norms, all right? So he says, judge for yourselves. Is it proper for an uncovered woman to be praying to God? Does not even nature, and again, nature there is not talking about biology, all right? It's talking about what is considered appropriate, generally speaking. All right. Does not even nature itself teach you that if a man should grow his hair long, it is dishonoring to him. But if a woman should grow her hair long, it is a glory to her. Now, I want you to underline where it says it is a glory to her. I want you to notice all the way back in verse 7, it said that the image and glory of God belongs to the man. That is, he is reflecting God's glory. He's not reflecting his own glory. He's reflecting God's glory. Right? Then he goes on to say, but the woman is the glory of man. That is, the glory that the woman has is she is reflecting the glory from her husband. Now, does that leave her without any of her own glory? See, the man has the woman as a reflection of his own glory. But the glory he radiates, he's reflecting from God. But now, he says in verse 15, he says, but if a woman should grow her hair long, it is a glory to her. Now, the woman is getting glory for herself. She's not reflecting the glory of a man. When the woman has longer hair and it's nicely kept, see, long hair, and when I say long, I don't mean it has to be, you know, down to your knees. I mean it's longer than my hair. It's hair that is not just, you know, neat, but it is styled to add a quality of beauty to the woman. So it's longer hair. Hair that can be curled or, you know, I'm not going to get into all that. But anyway, the point is that it's a glory to her. It is her hair is looked upon as being a way in which the woman beautifies herself and makes herself more attractive, right? It's her own glory because it's her own beauty that is being seen on the outside. And so it's a glory to her, right? Again, it's not her husband's glory. It's a glory to her. It's her own personal glory. And then he says, because her long hair has been given her. Now, some translations say as a covering, and that is very misleading. The word, I have it translated, has been given her as a mantle. The word itself refers to a garment. It was a sleeveless garment. It's like a cape that is thrown around the shoulders, not on the head. It did not cover the head. It was thrown around the shoulders, and you wrap yourself in it. And back in the day when the Bible was written, the Old Testament and the New Testament, some people had very nice, elaborate mantles that they covered themselves with. And the Bible talks about these mantles in different passages using the very same term here that is translated covering in the New King James, but it's literally a mantle. All right, it's talking about a very specific kind of garment. So I want to look at a couple of those because I want you to be clear about this, because a lot of people think they take that last verse and they say, oh, her long hair is given her for a covering. Okay, well then if the Bible says she has to be covered, that means she has to have long hair. No, that's not what it's saying at all. All right, it's saying her long hair is a glory to her. That is, it's her own glory. And it's because her hair has been given to her as a mantle, as a glorious outer garment that is in order to something really fancy, expensive, something that brings glory to the person who's wearing it. That's the point. It's not covering them so you can't see them. It's bringing glory to the person who's wearing this kind of a mantle. All right, so let's just look at three passages quickly, and then we'll be done. Judges chapter 8, verse 26. And when I say it's the same word, I mean it's in the Greek version, the Septuagint translation of the passages that we're going to read. It uses this very same word. Judges 8, 26. It says, now the weight of the gold earrings that he requested was 1,700 shekels of gold, besides the crescent ornaments, pendants, and purple robes. And the word robes there is the word, same word here. It's mantle. Which were on the kings of Midian, besides the chains that were about the camel's neck. So he's saying here that these were purple, and purple, I wore purple today. Purple was the color of royalty. And so these were purple outer garments because they made a fashion statement. All right, they brought attention and glory to the person who was wearing them. And here the kings of Midian were wearing these purple mantles, all right, using the very same word. All right, flip over to Ezekiel chapter 16. All right, Ezekiel 16 and verse 13. He says, here we go. Therefore, thus says the Lord God, I will cause a stormy wind to break forth in my fury, and there shall be a flooding rain in my anger. That's not the right verse. I'm in 13. Sorry. Ezekiel 16, 13. I was in chapter 13. All right. Thus you were adorned with gold and silver, and your clothing was of fine linen. And the word clothing there is the same word. And embroidered cloth. So this cloak or this mantle was made of fine linen and embroidered. It had embroidery, stitching in it, you know, fancy designs and things of that nature. You ate pastry, of fine flour, honey, and oil. You were exceedingly beautiful and succeeded to royalty. So again, the, hang on one second here. Sorry, my monitor went off, and I didn't know if I was still recording. But anyway, the point is, it's associated with royalty. We see the same thing in Ezekiel chapter 27 and verse 7. I won't go there because I'm really going long now. But anyway, the point that Paul's making here is that when the woman has long hair, it's given to her so that she has some glory of her own, something that makes her beautiful. All right, she can dress it up and make herself look nice, and it draws attention to her that she is beautiful and glorious. All right, but at the same time, she's supposed to be reflecting the glory of the man, he said earlier. So this is why he's doing here at the end is he's telling the congregation why the woman should cover her head. He gave two reasons. All right, number one, because of the angels. You're making a statement with regard to the angels who are watching, and the fact that you are submitting to your husband and you're approaching God through his authority and not going around his authority. You're not stepping outside of the bounds that God has given you. Okay, that's the message to the angels. Secondly, you have been given something by God, that's the long hair, as a mantle. As something of a thing of beauty, a thing of glory. But when you go into the presence of God, you don't come into the presence of God showing off your glory. You don't come in the presence of God making a fashion statement. You don't come into the presence of God as, look at me and my hairstyle and how beautiful I am because of my hair. You cover it up. You cover it up, number one, so that you are reflecting your husband's glory as opposed to your own glory. And the head covering is a symbol that you are covering up your own glory when you're approaching God as a means of humbly submitting to the order that God has established at the time of creation. All right, now just verse 16, I'll read it quickly and we'll be done. It says, if anyone seems to be contentious, that is, if anyone wants to argue about this, he says, we have no such custom, nor do the churches of God or the assemblies of God. What he means by that is the custom of being contentious about head coverings. He said, it's just not allowed. We just don't do that in the assemblies. And I want you to notice the assemblies of God is plural. What he's saying is this is the custom across the board. This is the custom in the assemblies of God. And we do not have such a custom of being contentious about this thing. All right, so Paul is kind of, in an indirect way, he's kind of putting the hammer down with regard to anybody who wants to argue about it. He's saying, look, that's, if somebody wants to argue about this, you're stepping outside of the norms of the way the Christian assemblies or Christian congregations handle themselves. All right, okay, I've gone long. I'm sorry, I apologize for that. But in any case, thanks for being with us. Next week, we're going to get into some more of these passages that we've talked about. And I'm looking forward to that. So God bless you all.